Everybody, hope you're well, and Baruch Hashem, it is brought down that before Mashiach comes, there will be more and more people that will see the truth of Torah and try to become Jews. One needs to know that they have to do it before Mashiach comes. The Gemara says once Mashiach comes, the gates are closed. When the Jews are doing really, really well, then we don't let the Goyim join. They have to join when things are tough for us. That's a sign of sincerity. Anyway, I want to announce that today, the 19th of Adar Aleph, the full day of learning is being sponsored by Yocheved and Rabbi Yeshua Bienenfeld in memory of, I'm not sure which mother, is it Yocheved's mother, whose yard site is on Shabbos, the 18th of Adar Aleph, Le'ilui Nishmat, Imi Morati Chaya Esther Bas Yisrael Moshe. We hope that all of the learning today should be Le'ilui Nishmata. We are obviously still in the book of Mishle, and we're not that far into it. We're still in Perek Dalet, and as I've said virtually every week, the section of 1 to 9, Aleph to Tes, is a general introduction to the actual proverb. So you tend to have fewer short sayings, fewer specific sayings, but much more general ideas of Musar and the Torah. So we're picking selected psukim. For example, look at Perek Dalet, Pasuk Yud Ches. The Gra has a beautiful explanation. This is chapter 4, verse 18. And it's consistent with his synonym explanation over and over again. Ki V'orach Tzadikim, the pathway of the Tzadik, Tzadikim, Ka'or Noiga, is like the brightening of the light, holeich va'or ad nachon hayom. It continues to increase until the beginning of the day. Now look at the next verse in contradistinction. Derech rishayim ka'afela, the way of the rishayim is in darkness, or is like darkness. Lo yadu bameh yikashelu. They don't even know what they are stumbling on. Not only do they stumble, thank you. They don't even know, thank you, what they are stumbling on. Now again, you will recall that the Gra has said over and over again, in many, many verses, that there is a difference between and derech, although we translate both of them as way or path. Derech is the highway, the common road, the road that many, many people travel. And Orach are the side streets, the small, narrow pathways that only a few people go on, either because they're difficult to traverse or because not too many people live there. You might have a nice little road, but nobody goes there. Here, the Gra points out that they walk on the Orach. They walk on a pathway. They walk on a road that is not trodden by many. Many find, maybe most of us find, that the way of a tzaddik is difficult. Superficially, it looks like a life of deprivation, a life of sacrifice, a life of extreme discipline. So it is an orach. If you remember the famous Tana, the author of the Zohar, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and he said to his son, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, they're both buried next to each other in Meiron, Ra'isi b'nei Aliyah, I have met people who are B'nai Aliyah. They are striving. That doesn't mean coming to Israel, Aliyah, but Aliyah is spiritual Aliyah. People who are working on themselves to reach the highest levels that they're capable. V'hein mo'atin. And they are very, very few B'nai Aliyah. And so, you know, we're overwhelmed by the details of daily life, etc. Then he goes out and says, interesting Gemara, and if there are only two in the world, it's you and I. And if there's only one in the world, it would be me. I'm quoting Shlomo Yochai. I'm talking about myself. All right, so the point, okay, that's a whole other question. But again, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai had an honest assessment that he was a Ben Aliyah. But I think it's common to say that, you know, when we read the biographies of Tzadikim and Gedolim, and sometimes some have criticized this as almost a disservice, we often encounter people that are so beyond us In fact, this was, I've mentioned this before, that you know, we can't even connect to them. We just marvel at their greatness. And this is true for men and women. There happen to be fewer biographies, so to speak, of great women, primarily because of their tzniyas. But if you read Rebbetzin Kanievsky, Rebbetzin Scheinberg, there are a few out there, and Baruch Hashem, I hope there'll be more as well. In fact, Rav Huttner, I've mentioned before, was actually critical. Many, many years ago, Rav Huttner was critical of the genre of Gedolim or Tzidkaniyos biographies, because they painted such models of perfection that there was no way we could relate to them. And Rav Huttner said, on one way that's erroneous, because these great people were not necessarily born supernaturally great. They worked on themselves. They had struggles. They had mistakes. You know, we know the Chafetz Chaim, by the time he was 80, trained himself to fall asleep if somebody spoke Lashon Hara. But what was the Chafetz Chaim like when he was 15 or 16 or 18? He went through the struggles. He had the same Yetzirah. Perhaps he had a greater Yetzirah, because Chazal say the greater a person, the greater the Yetzirah. And yet, we don't know their failures. We don't know their struggles. We don't know their mistakes. And Rav Huttner actually posited it would, now of course you have halachic problems of Lashon Hara writing biographies this way. But spiritually, it would be more helpful to us to see the struggles that the Gedolim had, that great people had, and how they overcame them. You know, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, you know, we know Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim Brisker, who already was Nifter quite a few years ago, he was Nifter in 1918, so there's almost virtually nobody in the world that actually knew Rav Chaim. Although until recently there were people who actually remembered Rav Chaim. That Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, everybody knows as the most brilliant analytical mind of a generation full of Gedolim. Right? In fact, Rav Chaim's analytical derech of learning is still the foundation, with all sorts of variations, of the learning in advanced yeshivas. Right? Rav Chaim literally created, as it were, the analytical structure of deep learning. But people say that there are two Gedolim that the world underestimates. People think the Chafetz Chaim was a bigger tzaddik than he was a gaon in learning. And people think Rav Chaim was a bigger gaon in learning than he was a tzaddik. And in fact, they got it wrong. The Chafetz Chaim was even a bigger gaon than he was a tzaddik. And Rav Chaim was a bigger tzaddik than he was a gaon. And that is, Rav Chaim's chesed, his loving kindness, was unbelievable. He, and I have to say his Rebbetzin as well. In Brisk, if there were, I guess there were single women that had children out of wedlock, and I guess it happened even then, or even out of adultery, they would drop the babies on Rav Chaim's doorstep. And he raised generations of children, as it were. When there was a fire in Brisk, and this was one of the shtetls that, well, Brisk was a big city, but most of the houses were wood, so once the fire started, everything got burnt down. It happens to be the Rav's house was not burnt down, but similar to New Orleans and Katrina and the like, it tends to be the houses in the poorer neighborhoods that are most flammable or destructible. Rav Chaim moved his bed into the street, and he said he is going to sleep outside until the houses are built for everybody. Rav Chaim's house often didn't, there were different times, there were no doors in the house. People could come in at any time, take whatever they wanted. In fact, the Brisker Rav, Rav Chaim's son, says that his father once asked him to Gemara to him, a Gemara in the house. And it turned out that somebody in the base medrash had just taken the Gemara and was learning with it, which is fine. Rav Chaim allowed it. So when the Brisker Rav went over to the person and said, you know, my father wants the Gemara, so he says, well, tell your father somebody else is using it right now. Now that was the way it was. Rav Chaim, and in fact, if you go to Warsaw, and it's interesting that why is Rav Chaim buried in Warsaw? Why are so many? The Warsaw Cemetery is the largest Jewish cemetery in the world, except for Har HaZeitim, which is older and of course larger. Many Gedolim. You know, it's interesting, if you go to the Warsaw Cemetery, you see such interesting things, because on one hand, there's a whole section for the great Rabbanim, Rabbi Kiva Eger, and the Nitziv, and Rav Chaim, and the Chemda Shlomo. These are just great, great, great Gedolim. And like a few feet away, they have these gaudy monuments to the founder of Esperanto, And there was a famous Polish-Jewish actress that made a whole fancy monument, really, really garish monument, etc. And they're all together. It just shows you that, you know, ultimately all Jews do come together, at least in the cemetery and the life. But on Rav Chaim's matseva, we would think, any yeshiva boy would think of Rav Chaim as the brilliant and the gain and the Talmud. It says, Ish Chesed, the person of loving kindness. That's what they said about Rav Chaim. By the way, you may wonder, why is everybody buried in Warsaw? The answer is many, many Gedolim died in Warsaw because in a last-ditch effort to get medical treatment, they came to Warsaw. That's what happened. Meaning to say, Warsaw had doctors and clinics and good hospitals, relatively speaking. So many, many great rabbis went there from other cities. They died there, and there was always a din, where should they be buried? But often the halacha is you bury as soon as possible. So instead of transporting the body back to where they lived, they actually had the minhag of burying him there. But be it as may, why am I bringing up Rav Chaim? Because on one hand, Rav Chaim was known for an extraordinary kindness. And yet he said on himself, now I don't know, I can't say if it's true, but this is what he said on himself, that by nature he was a very cruel and inconsiderate person. But he worked on himself. He knew that he needed to be a kinder, more generous person. And that's what he became because of his work. You know, so to say somebody was born a certain way is not always the case. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was really the most mild-mannered, also kind, extraordinarily kind person. I mean, there are so many stories. You know, on one hand, Rav Moshe learned every single moment that he could. On the other hand, when anyone asked him a shaila, he put down his pen and his notebook, and people said you never felt you were taking up his time. In fact, all sorts of stories. He did not know English very well, in spite of the fact that he lived in America for so many years. But when people used to give speeches in English, he would always be looking at them and nodding away. I don't know how much he understood the word, but he wanted the person to feel. They say, when women would visit his Rebbetzin, now this is pretty amazing. Women would visit his Rebbetzin, and he would be learning at the table. He would put away the sefer. He said it was not respectful to another person not to listen to their conversation. So he would sit and whatever their, I'm sure that maybe gave them a guilty feeling, I'm not sure, but he would sit and listen and interject. He said, it's not covered. You don't learn when people are talking because that implies that, you know, you're above them. This was Moshe Feinstein. But he said on himself, he too was a person who naturally had a bad temper. So the notion of working on oneself is really a phenomenally important idea because, you know, we give up right away. And the Gross says that is really what this pasuk is suggesting. First of all, the pathway of the righteous is a narrow pathway. It's orach. Because so many people don't go on that path. But it's not a pathway of immediate light. It's a pathway of gradualism. The analogy is that at night, there is darkness. And then gradually, as you approach the dawn, there begins to be the glimmering of light until you eventually have light. Now, this refers to a lot of things. This refers to spiritual development. It also refers that even when a person is a tzaddik, their life is not easy. Right? God does not give you all of your reward in this world. But the light gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Till eventually a person goes to Olam Haba with a huge, beautiful light. Right? So, of course, there's another pasuk that makes the same point. Again, a pasuk in Mishlei. Sheva yipail tzaddik v'kam. A very famous pasuk. The tzaddik falls seven times. And he gets up. And that doesn't just refer to physical obstacles. It refers to spiritual yerida. That there are yeridas in life. There are failures in life. There are sins that people commit. Tzaddikim commit sins as well. Ein tzaddik bi'aretz. Shlomo HaMelech says in Koheles. Ein tzaddik bi'aretz. Asher yaseh tov v'lo yechateh. There is no righteous person who is so pure that they don't sin. Chazal talk about, maybe Binyamin talks about, you know, less than a handful of people who perhaps escaped life without committing sin. Moshe Rabbeinu sinned, the greatest of the Nevi'im. But the difference between a tzaddik and a non-tzaddik is, a tzaddik does not allow his failures to crush him. That when he's no fail, he is come. For many of us, what happens is, you know, if I fail, that's a sign that maybe I'm not cut out for this. The tzaddik keeps on going. You know, the Gra describes even in Shmona Esrei. Let's say you're davening Shmona Esrei, and you decided you want to have kavana, and you want to have a good tefillah where you really think about what you're saying. Then Nebuch already, in the middle of maybe the first blessing, your mind wanders. So a person's attitude is, well, okay, I've lost this davening. Maybe next time I'll do it better. The Vilna Gaon says, no, every second is a new milchama. If the Eitz Hara won in Atzach Honein, you defeat the Eitz Hara in Hashiveinu Avinu L'Sarasecha. And if he wins you in the next one, you win him in the next one. There is no concept of conceding defeat. You go on, you get up. And that is why it describes this pasuk, similar to Sheva Yipol Tzadik, that the light is gradual. You don't see things right away. You know, it's interesting that years ago, when I remember learning in elementary school, you know, the United States had the War of 1812 against the British. And perhaps you might remember from the old country the idea that the peace treaty for the War of 1812, which was signed in Belgium, the Treaty of Ghent, was actually signed the United States and Britain did not stop fighting till 3 weeks after the peace treaty was signed, because it took that amount of time to get the news over. In fact, Andrew Jackson, who became president of the United States largely because of his heroism in the War of 1812, won his medal for a battle that took place after the peace treaty was signed. That's how slow life was, right? Life was very slow at some point in our history. Now, to flash forward to the present, when I got my first fax machine around 25 years ago, when you had, you know, the old faxes, so I needed to send a fax from Baltimore to China. And it took 35 seconds. And I was drumming my fingers and I was saying, what is taking so long? What is wrong with this machine? Now, to go from Baltimore to China in 35 seconds, we are now impatient. Why is it taking so long? But the answer is, of course, we have become conditioned to instant gratification. And that's our whole society. If something is broken, you don't fix it, you get rid of it. Rahman al-Islam, this has even occurred with, you know, pregnancies, abortion, and the outside world, and the like. Marriages, for sure, you know, even within the Torah world. Divorces rise so much because people... Now, again, obviously the Torah allows for divorce, and there are times when divorce is necessary. Obviously, that's an issue. But there's also an issue where people just work on things less than we used to do. So the truth of the matter is, even in Ruchnis, there is a concept that people want instant gratification. They want nirvana. They want instant spirituality. That is why, to some degree, the popularization of Kabbalah among Hollywood actors and the like is kind of the key to get something instant. Segulos. Put a red string or drink this water. Now, the Brisker Rav was not a big fan of Hasidim generally, but there was one Hasidic Rebbe that he liked a lot. And this Hasidic Rebbe had a very small following. So somebody asked the Brisker Rav, why do you like this Rebbe so much? Like, he doesn't even have any Hasidim. He says, well, I tell you why I like this Rebbe. Someone comes to the Rebbe and says, give me a segula for finding a shidduch. So the Rebbe says, learn Maseches Kedushin in depth. Give me a bracha for Parnassa. Says, learn Bava Metzia, Be'ian. So, not too many people stayed with this rabbi because, you know, they wanted like a cookie. They wanted a cookie thing. He's giving them, you know, learn hundreds of blot. The Brisker Rav says, that's my type of rabbi. And that is, in fact, even the Sfas Emes, somebody asked the Sfas Emes, what's the best segula for something?
He said, the best segula is Vayisam li segula mikol ha'amim. Hashem says, you need to be God's treasure. You live a life of segula, that's your segula. Right? But again, I'm not denigrating segula. Segulas have a role in Yiddishkeit. I'm not saying they do not. But when we use them as a shortcut for spiritual work, for Torah, for tefillah, for chesed, for trying to improve our midos, which are so difficult, then it becomes a cheap shortcut, and it's just like any other instant gratification. And that's what this pasuk is saying, says the Gra. The way of the tzaddik is not sudden enlightenment. It's gradual light. A little bit at a time. Brick after brick. Sometimes two steps forward and one step back, and sometimes one step forward and even two steps back. But you don't give up. You keep on going. And eventually you will have the light. You will see the light. This world, next world, we don't know. But there will be a light at the end of the tunnel. And as a result, the tzaddik sees the light even in the tunnel. Because he knows that Hashem is with him. He knows that as he's trying, he or she knows as they are trying, as they are striving, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is rooting for their success in every possible way. And that is why it is called Orach, because it is the way of the few. It is not the common path. As opposed to Rishayim, Derech, it's a wide open road. A lot of people travel there. That's why they say Gehenim is larger than Gan Eden, right, so to speak, because it's got to accommodate more people. You know, a lot of rooms there, and the like. But Afela, it is described as darkness. It's very, very interesting that Rav Leib Chassman, great, great Mashgiach of Chevron, he was Rav Shalom Shradran's Rebbe. So a lot of Rav Chassman's teachings that we know from Rav Shalom Shradran. He once gave a mashal about a Polish peasant who came to the big city for the first time. Now, he was on the outskirts. He was a farmer. He didn't know anything. And he was told that if he buys a piece of paper and goes into this building, a movie theater, he didn't know what that was, he would see people and animals coming out of the wall as if they magically appeared. And he didn't really understand what that was. But he bought a ticket, and he's sitting in a totally dark room. Totally dark. He doesn't know what's going on. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there are animals, I guess they like the Westerns in Poland, and animals and people coming out of the wall, and he didn't understand. He didn't see a door in that wall when he walked in. So he couldn't understand, where did these people and animals come from? So he took one of his other purchases, a nice new flashlight, battery flashlight, and he shined it on the wall where the screen was to see if he could find a secret door. But of course, when you turn on the bright lights, the movie images vanish. So people were yelling at him, they were screaming at him, shut off the flashlight, we can't see the movie when the flashlight is on. Meaning, certain things look real when you're in the dark. But when you turn on the lights, you realize how fake they really are. And Rav Leib Chassman said, that is a mashal, that is a parable for life. Because when you sit in the darkness, which is another way of saying, you don't think about what is the purpose of my life. Because we do get so involved in the day-to-day things that have to be done, that we literally get blinded because of the trees. We don't see the overall forest. The foliage, as it were, blinds us. And when you sit in darkness, two things happen. You think things are real when they're not. But at the same time, things that are real, you're not going to notice. I mean, imagine you're sitting in a movie theater. Of course, nobody here goes to movies, but okay. But you may have read about it. You're sitting in a movie theater. And right next to you is a bag of diamonds. But you didn't notice, it was dark. So on one hand, you see what is not real as if it's real, and you don't see the reality that's right there.
So too. There's so much in our life that, in a sense, is not real. The grudges, the resentments, the feelings of, you know, lack of self-worth, which are fundamentally not true, because every person is beloved by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And they become so dominant that they control our life. But they're not real. If you turn on the lights, those things vanish. And yet, there are realities that are so significant that we don't even pay attention to them. We don't notice them. That is what darkness is. So what the tzaddik is focusing on is the tzaddik focuses on the lights. The tzaddik says, well, you know, the light will not always be clear and very, very bright, be a little at a time, but my job is to try to find that light and connect to that light. The Rasha walks in darkness because the Rasha is led astray by the imaginary terrors of the night that control his life and does not perceive the reality of what life is about. And as a result, when he stumbles, when he trips, he doesn't even realize, where did all the years go? Where did the years go? And again, this is not a question of necessarily even talking about the highest levels. Oh, yeah, thank you. When you have a person, let's say, who devoted his life, you know, to his career. Now, careers are important. Careers are an avenue of productivity. It's an avenue of supporting a family. It's an avenue of contributing something positive. I'm not denigrating at all careers and the like. But let's say a person does it, and a person, you know, never spent time with his children, never spent time with his spouse. And then at the very end of one's life, assuming one has the consciousness at the end of one's life, not everyone is zochet to that. So nobody leaves the world thinking, you know, I wish I would have spent one more Sunday at the office. I'm thinking, I mean, again, Sunday's a working day here, but I'm going back to American Mishalim, forgive me. I wish I would have spent one more Sunday at the office. That's not how a person thinks. A person will think, you know, why didn't I, you know, tell my children I love them more? These are things that are going to bother a person at the end, at the very end. So if Baruch Hashem, we hope we're not at the very end. So we have a way of fixing those things that are going to bother us at the very end. That's what it means to turn on the lights. And of course it applies to Avodas Hashem, to mitzvot, to chesed. Right? So that's the idea, that the tzaddik's light is gradual. The Rasha doesn't bother to turn on the lights. And therefore at the very end they won't know what hits them. Right? To live a life in which, I remember reading a quote where a very wealthy person was bemoaning the fact that he's leaving all of his wealth to people who don't even like him. He was talking about his children, right? Rahman al-Islam, such a feeling, so sad. But sometimes that is the reality. Okay, so that's just what I wanted to comment on that pasuk. I'm going to skip down a little bit. If you go down to pasuk Chaf Beis, I just want to share a drasha from the Gemara again. This is discussing wisdom, holding on to wisdom, not turning away from the wisdom of life. Now remember, Chachma, as we've said, is not so much factual knowledge even of Torah, but it is the wisdom of knowing what is the purpose of life. And the pasuk says, Ki chayim heim lemotzehem. Wisdom is life to those who find it. Find them, plural, because this is wisdom is plural here. Ulechol b'saro marpe, and to all of your flesh, meaning all of your physical ailments, so to speak, it will give healing. Now, this has, number one, a certain scientific validity, as a matter of fact. And that is, when a person feels that their life matters, that their life has a purpose, that they are connected to something greater than themselves, then even their physical ailments and pains do not become as unbearable. You know, there is a movement throughout the world to legalize suicides. Now, of course, well, suicide itself is a crime, but it's not a prosecutable crime, because if a person killed themselves, only Hashem will prosecute. But there's no way, you know, you cannot go to jail for committing suicide. But as a corollary of that, though, assisting in a suicide is a crime. Now, as you know, though, there is a movement throughout the world to legalize what is called physician-assisted suicide. A number of Scandinavian countries have allowed it, even though it's been shown that a lot of the people who actually were killed this way were suffering under temporary depression. They would have gotten over it in a day or so. In two states, in Washington and Oregon, there actually is the legalization of assisted suicide, and there are people pushing for its legalization all over the United States, although it probably will not be enacted in too many states. But it's been pointed out that, in a sense, people commit suicide largely because of a fear of pain, which is a very great thing. But also there's a psychological component that they feel they're not contributing, they're not needed, they're not useful. They don't have the physical ability, they're dependent on others. And that goes back to a certain mindset, that my value is only what I can do in the external world, whether it's make money or whatever it is. And when I'm not able to do those things, my life has no value. But if a person feels that they have a purpose, then even if there's a lot of suffering, and Rahman al-Islam, Hashem should save all of us, and all of Klal Yisrael, and every person from this great suffering, it is a great thing, an awful thing. But when a person has a purpose in life, they can grit their teeth and go on, because they feel needed. That is why it is said that even having a pet or a plant to take care of can give a person a willingness to live. Even something like that can give a person a sense. In fact, the Yerushalmi actually says, it's interesting, that on Rosh Hashanah, when Hashem decides who will live and who will die, sometimes a person doesn't deserve to live, but his animals depend on him. That's why he says, Amu Vehema Toshia Hashem, man and beast does God save. And the Gemara has a drasha, sometimes man is saved because of the behema. In other words, he doesn't deserve it, but his dog needs him, we'll give him another year, and the like. There is such a concept. Maybe that's an argument to get a pet, just in case, as an insurance policy, or whatever. I think I mentioned before the story with Rabbi Levin, where a life insurance salesman was trying to sell him a life insurance policy. And he said, you know, if I buy a life insurance policy, I'm putting my life in danger. Because he says, every Rosh Hashanah, Hashem is deciding, do I deserve to live? And Rav Aryeh said in his humility, I certainly do not deserve to live, but my Rebbetzin needs me. So I get life in her zechus. So what's going to happen? We get life insurance. So the same thing is going to happen on Rosh Hashanah. The Midas Adin is going to say, Rav Aryeh doesn't deserve to live. The Midas Harachmim says, his Rebbetzin needs him. The Midas Adin says, no, she doesn't. He has life insurance. He's doing fine. She'll do fine. So he said, again, this is not a psak. He said he would rather not have life insurance, because that way he can continue to say his Rebbetzin needs him in one way or the other. Okay. So Chol Besoro Marpeh is quite serious, meaning it doesn't necessarily mean the pains go away. But when you connect to a higher purpose, you can bear the pain much more, because there's a reason to go on. Now, Chazal have a beautiful, interesting drasha from this, that instead of motsehem, right, because when you don't have vowels, right, we don't have vowels in the text itself, they were put in later, so you can read the words in different ways. So instead of motsehem, those who find them, we can read it motsiehem, those who bring it out, who articulate it. And Chazal here, this is the source that when a person learns Torah, ideally, they should speak and verbalize the words and not just think about it. That's why you walk into a yeshiva or whatever, even if a person is learning by themselves, they learn out loud. And it is actually based on a drash for this pasuk that the words of the Torah need to be physically articulated. So it becomes a physical part of yourself, not just in the realm of the mind. Of course, that raises interesting halachic questions about how loud should a person be? Is there a concept of disturbing other people's concentration? Interesting question. Some people say, no, a Beis Medrash is supposed to be as loud as possible. It's not a university library. Others say that even in a Beis Medrash, there is a concept of trying to have a certain respect or consideration for the other person. I will leave that to the individual yeshiva. But this is the makor of Chazal. Now, if you look at the next pasuk, Pasuk of Gimel, again, we're just going over very selectively. Mikol mishmor nitzor libecha ki mimenu totzaot chayim. Now, here, it's very important. In Hebrew, it's sometimes difficult to know whether a given word is a subject or an object. Let's take a phrase, nitzor libecha. Now, nitzor, we know what nitzor means. Nitzor means to guard, to watch, to protect. Nitzor l'shoncha meira means guard your tongue. Keep guard over your tongue so it does not say mirma, deceit, or lashon hara, and the like. But nitzor libecha could be translated, so we know what nitzor means, but nitzor libecha, does that mean your heart shall guard? Or you should guard your heart? Meaning, in English we would describe, is it the object or the subject? And what is the first phrase? Mikol mishmor, from every mishmor. What is a mishmor here? So the Gra says, really, a quite beautiful thought. The Gra says that mishmor are anything in life that you want to guard and protect because it's precious. Right? Each person has something that they would call their mishmor. Would be my family, my children, my reputation, my business. So mishmor are those inyanim in your life that a person wants to protect. He doesn't want them to be hurt. He doesn't want them to be diminished. So the pasuk is saying, your heart is the most precious thing that you have. Mikol mishmor nitzor libecha means guard your heart more than you would guard anything else in your life that you want to protect. So it doesn't mean guard your heart from the mishmor. See, again, the mem is a little ambiguous. The mishmor is not the thing that's attacking you, but rather it's a relational thing. Guard your heart more than you guard any mishmor. Now, what does it mean to guard your heart? Now, we're not talking about a low cholesterol diet and oat fiber, although that's good advice too. But that's not what is being referred to here. But a person's heart, metaphorically, is described as a person's sensitivities, a person's feelings. And there is a reality that a person can become coarsened and desensitized to many, many beautiful things because of the decadence of society or the life that they live in, the surroundings, their environment. Things that, in fact, it's been said that once you lose the capacity to blush, to be embarrassed over something, because you're so used to it, someone makes an off-color joke or whatever it is, you never gain that sensitivity again. And guarding your heart means the sense of trying to preserve, at least within the recesses of your home or yourself, a sense of holiness, a sense of goodness, a sense of standard, a sense of value. And guard that more preciously than you guard anything else. Mikol mishmor nitzor libecha. Because from that inner sense of who you are and what your life represents, everything else that is truly precious in your life, your family, your children, are going to be preserved as well. Because, you know, the sad news for parents is, you know, people say, how do you have great children? Well, a lot of it, of course, is not in our hands. It's Hashem's bracha, tefillah.
But to the degree that we can do anything, you get great children by being a great parent, by being a great person. Meaning, it's said that no one has the Yetzer Hara about their children. I want my child to learn all the time. I want my child to be a tzaddik. I want my child to be a chesed, etc. But how much do we do? Meaning, what can you expect? And I remember years ago, I won't mention the community because it was I was in a number of communities in my life, so hopefully nobody will identify. But I was attending a Vada Chinuch, or Board of Education meeting, and this was a bit of a modern school. So the parents were discussing what extra learning we could put on the kids. A Mishmor Thursday, a Sunday morning, you know. Now, I knew a lot of the parents, and I knew that a number of them were not into doing learning themselves. So here's the question, you know, how do you expect your children to gravitate towards learning if that's not what the parents themselves do? Or sometimes you can have a parent who will be busy talking in shul, and when he sees his kid talking, he will interrupt the conversation to say, keep quiet in shul, then go back to talking. Rav Huttner used to say, what does the child learn from that encounter? He learns that when he grows up, he'll tell his child not to talk in shul. That's the lekach. So in truth, in many, many ways, you want to have a good kid, you got to be a good parent. Now, there are miracles in the world. Sometimes you can have the most wonderful children from parents who don't seem to be b'nei aliyah. There may be zechusim there. And the other, and unfortunately, tragically, sadly, the opposite is true as well. Wonderful, righteous, holy parents. And sometimes the child goes off the derech. So God forbid, there's no suggestion of blaming because this is part of the hashgacha that is sometimes mysterious and we don't fully understand it. And it can work in both ways. The bad parents, so to speak, whatever that means exactly, may be blessed with absolute wonderful children. And the wonderful, wonderful parent may sometimes suffer the difficulty of trying to bring a child back. Which is, of course, very, very sad. But those are kind of miracles on both sides of the spectrum. If you're talking about derech hateva, what do I do in terms of normal ishtadlus? The best way you raise your children to be righteous people is you got to try to be a righteous person. Now, the problem is, I have no yetzer hara when it comes to my children being righteous. But I do have a big yetzer hara when it comes to me being righteous, because that requires, you know, me having the discipline. And that's more difficult. That requires that I go on the orech of the tzaddik, not only that I put my child. The Kutzker Rebbe used to say he would love to meet the last child of history for whom everybody's been living. Because every parent says, oh, I'm doing this, you know, for my children. And the children grow up and say, I'm doing it for my children. So there'll be some kid at the end of time that everything was being done for. And the like. The Kutzker Rebbe said, I'd like to know that child. And therefore, that is mikol nishman etzor libecha, meaning to say, more than your children, more than everything, if you guard and nurture the purity of your heart, everything else will come from that. Everything will flow from the purity that you keep in your heart, and that is mikol mishmar etzor libecha. And that's what the end of the pasuk says, ki mimenu, from the heart that is pure, totsaot chayim. Totsaot are the consequences of life. All that is good in life will flow from that heart, from the heart that is good. Of course, if you remember, Pirkei Avos, actually, I don't know if it's based on this pasuk per se. Do you remember a very famous passage where Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai had five talmidim, and he asked the talmidim to identify what is the derech to which a person should connect himself? So one said, chaver tov, either have a good friend or be a good friend. It's not that clear how you translate it. Shochein tov, either be a good neighbor or have a good neighbor. Again, it's not clear if it's a have or a be. One said, roes anolat, to be able to look into the, in other words, to see the consequences of your actions, to be clear-headed enough to see the consequences of your actions. Another person said, Ayin Tov. Ayin Tov is to look at people with generosity of spirit. But the final Talmud, Rav Elazar ben Arach, said, Lev Tov, a good heart. And Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai said, that covers everything. because a person with a lev tov will be a good friend to those that he knows well, will be a good neighbor to those he doesn't know that well, but they're neighbors. He will weigh the consequences of his actions, not to hurt other people needlessly. That's Roeh Sanola. He will ayin tova, he will rejoice in the successes of others. That's what an ayin tov is, that he rejoices in other people, even if he didn't do anything towards it. He rejoices in their successes. So michlal devarav divrayim, right? All of your words are michlal, and that's what it says, mikol mishmor nitzor libecha ki mimenu totzaot chayim. Okay. I'll do one more pasuk quickly, although I'll probably have to leave it over for next time a little bit more. Look at pasuk chavdalet. Again, just looking back to the next pasuk. Hotzer mimcha ikshus peh ulezus sefasayim harcheik mimeka. Ikshus is crookedness, right? So remove from yourself the crookedness of the mouth, and be marchik, distance from yourself, lezus sefasayim. Lezus is the turning away of the lips. Now, the simple pshat of this pasuk is that there are two different things. Peh refers to the, so ikshus peh, the Vilna Gaon says, the crookedness of the mouth is what we call echad bepeh v'echad belev. Mean crooked, meaning to say what I say doesn't correspond to what I think. Meaning to say, I think all sorts of negative things about a person, but I make believe I'm their friend. And that's called ikshus peh, echad bepeh v'echad belev. Now, this is condemned. You're not supposed to be echad bepeh v'echad belev. So what does that mean exactly? Does that mean if I don't like somebody, I'm supposed to tell them? No, you are a rotten person. I mean, you're telling me it's wrong for me to speak to them in a nice, positive way when in fact I have resentment. The answer is, of course you don't go around telling people you're a rotten person. But the Torah itself says that when there are disagreements, when there are differences, when there is hurt, there is a certain importance to speaking it out, to talking it, to diffusing the tension by honest communication. Now, there are going to be exceptions to every rule, and in these inyanim, there are many exceptions. There are times when something is so toxic that you disengage or you don't involve yourself in confrontation. But by and large, the Torah itself, this is not just modern psychology, the Torah itself in the mitzvah of tochacha, that's why it says, lo sisne esachicha bilvorecha, do not hate your fellow Jew in your heart. That means speak out what the problem is. Talk about it. And when you talk about it, a few things can happen. One thing that might happen is you might realize you got the whole story wrong. And what you thought was the most awful thing, the person was not behaving in a bad way. Or the other thing can happen, the other way around. The person did behave badly, but they didn't realize that it hurt you. And now they realize. And things can get a lot better. Now, as I say, there are exceptions, so one should think about this and talk to the people that can give you advice about this. But as a general rule, this is why we condemn ikshus peh. Because when people are not saying what they mean, then all you're doing is compounding misunderstandings and resentments under a veneer of civility and politeness. And things never get better. They just never get better unless a problem is addressed. You sweep it under the rug, eventually it explodes like a pressure cooker. So that's what's called ikshus peh. Now, laza sefasayim, the Gra says, is simply saying bad things about people directly. Meaning ikshus peh is the hypocrite of echad v'pechad belev, and laza sefasayim is when I just disparage people and I don't try to see their good. In other words, both are no good. Meaning, it's not good to be a hypocrite. See, that's why you almost have a contradiction here. Meaning, don't be a hypocrite and say nice things about a person if you don't mean it. And then it says, and don't say bad things. Right? So you have to navigate the idea of honest communication in a non-judgmental way. Meaning to say,
you honestly want to bridge the gap. You want to try to make shalom. You want to try to understand. Now, there's no guarantee that you'll be successful, but you try. And if that doesn't work, then you have to retreat or go to stage two or whatever it is, the plan B or whatever it is. But plan A is to try to speak it out in a positive way. Now, this is the simple meaning of the pasuk, which is totally valid, but let me point out that the Gemara in Yevamos has a whole other interpretation. And the Gemara in Yevamos says this is referring to protecting your reputation, meaning don't do things that cause other people to talk negatively about you. Meaning remove from yourself the negativities that people might say about you. Which means to say, this is the whole concept in halacha called marasayan, that even if you're doing something that's 100% correct, people will interpret it or might interpret it in a negative way. You have to avoid even the appearance of impropriety. There's a book Feldheim published a number of years ago, When Black Becomes a Rainbow. It was about a woman, a non-religious woman, who wrote about her children, her daughter, who became very religious. A very interesting book was written from the non-religious woman's perspective about the different conflicts that they faced until they navigated, and eventually they lived with shalom, etc. So she says over there that she's from Australia. So she says that her daughter came to visit with the Haredi grandchildren, with sitches out and payas, etc. And the mother wanted to show off her grandchildren to the kind of the non-religious Jewish friends. And she took them to a restaurant, and everything was kosher, everything was made specially for them, etc. So the woman kept on saying all the time, there might be marasayan here, marasayan. So the mother didn't know what marasayan was. So she says, who is this marasayan? like he's watching everything you're doing? But marasayan or marasayan, however you want to pronounce it, does refer to the idea that we have an achrayas to preserve our shem tov, our good name in the world. Because our good name is how we can influence and be a force for good. So if we drag our name into the dirt, we've compromised our ability to make Kiddush Hashem in the world. So the Gemara in Yevamos says that you are obligated, each of us is obligated, to remove behaviors that cause others to talk about it in a negative way. Now, sometimes we don't have control. If somebody's just making up stuff, maybe I can't do anything about that. But if I did something that could be interpreted in a negative way, I have an achrayas not to do it. Now, specifically, this has a halachic. Let me give you some halachic applications. The Gemara uses this drash for a halacha. And that is, if witnesses testify to the death of a woman's husband, right, they simply testify that Reuben died. They are not allowed to marry the woman. Meaning a witness to the death of a man cannot marry the wife because people will say, oh, maybe you're lying, you just wanted to marry her, right? Things like that to avoid the appearance of impropriety. A beis din, a rabbi on a beis din that was megayer a woman is not allowed to marry the woman. It has to be somebody else. Now, if you understand the concept, because there is what is called lazut sefatayim. People are going to say, you really didn't do your job to check her out. You were just doing it for that reason. Right? So, according to the Gra, therefore, we'll stop here, the pasuk is referring to the notion that you must engage in honest discussion with people. Don't be echad b'pev, echad b'leiv. According to the Gemara, it is referring to the preservation of your shame tov and not to do things that cause people to talk negatively about you. Okay, have a good